The meeting of the House Senate Committees on Education Policy will come to order for this informational meeting on the state's ESSA plan. The clerk will note the roll. We're here today to fulfill a provision that was in session law, Section 53 of the Omnibus Bill, that at least 30 days before submitting the plan to the United States Department of Education, we would have this hearing to learn about the progress that's being made. So welcome back, members. It's kind of like old home week. It's good to have the socialization going on. Welcome back, staff. And a special welcome to those who came to listen or to provide testimony following the presentations by the commissioner and her staff. And an extra special welcome to Commissioner Caselius and to her staff, who I know have worked over a year to prepare this plan. Members, please indicate when you may have questions as we proceed through the presentation for all MDE staff, because you may want to ask questions at the intervals rather than at the end, because if you've gone through the plan, you know this is organized differently, organized by title rather than by theme, so you might have different questions to ask at times that would be unusual, considering the fact that we often hear all the testimony and then ask questions. So with that, welcome Commissioner Caselius. Please say your name for the record and begin. And members, just to remind you, you have in your packets the plan, the PowerPoint, the document that is the decision document, and you may also have some testimonies that we have pre-placed. And of course, members, don't forget to fill out your reimbursement sheets now that we have been funded. My budget is whole. I can't say that to the senator, but welcome, Senator Pratt. It's great to have you at the table with me. But the House haven't spent any money out of our budget yet anyway, so please hand those to Andrew or to Tom at the end of the hearing for the House so I can sign them after you've signed them. So again, sorry, Commissioner Caselius, for that little interlude, but welcome again, and please say your name and begin.
Brenda Caselius, Commissioner of Education for the State of Minnesota, Representative Erickson, Senator Pratt, members, thank you for having us today to talk about the Every Student Succeeds Act, which replaces the No Child Left Behind Act, and the original Civil Rights Law of 1965, the Elementary Secondary Education Act of the federal government. I especially want to thank my team first for the many hours and meetings that they've had to engage stakeholders. As you recall, our very first meeting on the new law was with both committees at the Department of Education, very well attended by members, to just go through what we were going to be doing over the next year and a half in order to engage stakeholders, parents, teachers, advocates, students in this work, and then try to come up with the best plan that we could for the state of Minnesota in the time in which we had, knowing that there would still be some work left to do, given that there's been a transition with the new administration at the federal level, and moving forward with the reporting components, some of the implementation that was delayed, and some of the other provisions that are not required at this time. So know that the plan that we provide to you today are the components that are due this next September. However, there are implementation pieces that we will continue to update you on, as well as really robust reporting that we plan on doing so that it's clear to the public and to our teachers, so that what we are producing is useful to student learning and that we can ensure that every student has an equitable and excellent education. And so those are our goals as we move forward. What I plan on doing is presenting kind of an overview of where we've been, and then leaving it to my team to talk to the technical nature of the provision, seeing if we still have time. I'll answer some quick questions, but I do need to return to the agency for an afternoon meeting that I have scheduled with the Student Safety Technical Assistance Center Advisory Group. So I'll go ahead. We'll start with my formal presentation and then take questions at the end, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Okay. So moving toward, I'm going to skip the first slide because I talked about that a little bit. Moving toward our engagement that we've had, again, I mentioned that we started out with meeting with the legislature. The bill was passed in December of 2015 and signed into law by President Obama at that time. And then we started looking at what some initial guidance was and started some initial conversations with stakeholders around some of the key components of the law and some of the key indicators, some of the academic indicators, our growth indicators, and started really engaging largely with key school folks, key advocates, and our diverse communities. We began talking to our Tribal Nations Education Committee and some of the key civil rights groups within our community. We held over 300 statewide meetings. They were regional meetings, community meetings. We had surveys. We used some of our technology to do Twitter town hall, focus groups, webinars, and other such meetings, working again with students and families and advocates. This included hundreds, maybe I think thousands of hours and thousands of stakeholders at many of these regional and community and technical meetings. Out of those meetings came a broader vision for what we would like to see within and captured within the Every Student Succeeds Act, some of which we are able to do and some of which we are not able to do because of the constraints of the federal law. The largest focus that we saw very clearly from our stakeholder engagement was that folks were telling us that they really wanted a plan for all students. They wanted it to be equitable. They wanted us to count all student groups and to be sure that they were weighted enough so that they weren't lost in the overall grouping of all students at a school. They wanted to make sure that there was a focus on early learning and a pre-K through 12th grade approach, focusing on transitions and focusing on flexibilities within the funding to be able to ensure every child has a great start as well as a strong program throughout that is aligned to academic standards that are college and career ready and also fair assessments. They also really wanted a well-rounded education. They wanted to have things like PE. We had our PE folks show up at all our meetings. That was wonderful advocacy, as well as librarians and science folks and social studies. They wanted to have their subjects or their disciplines have equal value and equal time for students, including things like project-based learning, authentic assessments. And within some of these, I think this is the biggest area of opportunity that I felt we did not have within the law in terms of changing our assessments. The federal law still requires that we use statewide assessments. All students still had to be tested on the same tests. They had to have 95% participation. So there were a number of things still within the No Child Left Behind law that were key protections in terms of their thought of including those in the law for civil rights and ensuring that every student had an equitable and excellent education. And so those things continued then in the federal law around assessments. So there's not a lot of wiggle room in assessments. There was opportunity within the federal law for seven states to apply for some more innovative types of assessments. However, we've seen that would be quite costly to do, and at this time it was just determined that that's not something we can do, but we may be able to pursue later on. They wanted support for both schools and districts. Historically, the support provided has been at the school level. It became very clear that the stakeholders were telling us that they wanted the support to be at the district level as well, since districts are ultimately responsible, as well as a strong alliance to the World's Best Workforce legislation, assuring that that also was prioritized within the plan and that you align it as best you can with the goals and the strategies within that work that school districts have been embarking on, and that's also a tool used and leveraged within this current model in order to push the agenda for all kids. And then finally, they heard we heard that they would like to see more plain language, an easier website to use for reporting out to parents, assuring that the performance reports that we do give are useful to teachers in terms of student learning, that it's timely and that it's easy to read. We are currently in a statewide branding effort, and we'll be undergoing a lot of changes to our website, so it didn't make sense to spend a lot of time on all of that changing of our report card at this point, while we're focused on the components of the system. But over the next year, we are committed to creating reporting systems that are detailed, that are transparent. There's a requirement within the law for fiscal transparency, so we'll be working with Dr. Melcher and his team around fiscal transparency opportunities to give to our stakeholders and communities and local school boards information about all the categorical aids, supplement supplant provisions, and all of the technicalities that go with how money is spent and how it's prioritized within a district on the strategies that will most move achievement forward for kids. So there were five state plan committees that then came out of this work, and then a number of subcommittees that did work underneath those committees. The key committees we created were assessment, accountability, school improvement, educator quality, and English language learners. We had a lot of help and feedback from key stakeholder advocacy groups and teachers and principals. Everybody was very much included in the subcommittee work. And then we gathered together, and all of that got funneled in with the advisory accountability committee to put together these recommendations. So Wayne Nguyen has been leading this work, assistant commissioner, with Greg Keith, chief academic officer, working on school improvement and the school support side of things and teacher quality. And then Stephanie on the technical nature of the accountability system and also the writing of the plan. And then I don't want to miss out on Michael Dietrich, who also traveled across the entire state with us, listening and gathering feedback so that we could pull together the best information for you and for the state of Minnesota that we think will help move the needle forward within the constraints of the law, the way that we see it. So I'm going to turn it over to Stephanie now, I think, who is going to speak about standards and assessments and go through some of those technical things. We'll try to be rather brief and thorough in our discussion so that there's still time yet for you to ask me questions if you need to ask me any questions before I have to leave. So thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome, and please say your name for the record and begin, Ms. Graff.
Great, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Graff, Chief Accountability Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm going to touch on standards and assessment first, just very briefly, and then I'll spend a bit of time going through the components of our accountability system that you saw in the draft state plan and that is in the decisions document as well. Myself, Wei, and Greg will actually all be referencing this decisions document, so you'll want to have this handy and in front of you, because we didn't include a lot of the information in the PowerPoint itself, but we wanted to walk through this document with you all today. As far as standards and assessments, this is one area within the ESSA law that Minnesota will not initially be making really any changes. We will stick with our Minnesota academic standards that are defined, of course, in state law, and the revision timeline and things are defined in state law as well. Those college and career-ready standards in the same subject areas will stay in place under our new ESSA plan as well. Assessments, the commissioner did mention a couple of the potential flexibilities down the road with assessments in the context of the ESSA law. In the short term right now, our MCAs, Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, will stay in place, administered in grades 3 through 8 in high school in math and reading, and administered in grades 5, 8, and once in high school in science as well. Those assessments will remain, and will be used as a significant part of the accountability system as well, as I'll talk through in a couple minutes here. All right. I'm going to get to the accountability system and kind of dive in to some of the details of our accountability system that we've built with stakeholders over the course of the last year. So again, I'm going to reference this decisions document. I'm going to start actually on the back page where on the bottom right it says statewide long-term goals. I'll talk about the goals in the plan. I'll talk about the indicators used within accountability, and then I'll talk a little bit about how we're identifying schools for support. As far as our statewide long-term goals, you can see some of them listed there. What we heard from stakeholders are a few things with regards to setting our goals. First, you can see with some of them the sense of urgency, and these were really set based on meeting ambitious expectations at a given point in time. Stakeholders really wanted the same expectations to be set for every single student group. We see across the country in some states where we're seeing different expectations for goals being established for different student groups, but we wanted the same high bar, the same expectation for every single student group in the state when it comes to setting these goals, so that our students of color, our low-income students, our English learners, and our students in poverty have the same bar at the same point in time that they're striving to reach as our white students that may be more affluent. So the goals are listed here. As you all may be familiar, we have been, under our waiver and under the world's best workforce, actually reporting on an annual basis where every single district is and every single school is relative to statewide goals, and we will continue to do that, to be really transparent in how schools are performing and how they're progressing and moving towards these ambitious long-term goals. In math and reading, our goal is to reach a proficiency index, and I'm going to talk in a minute about proficiency index, just wanted to mention that. But a proficiency index of 90 with no student group below 85 by the year 2025, so that would be a seven-year goal if we were to use 2017 as a baseline. Looking back at 2016 results, because we don't yet have 2017 assessment results, this is about a 22-point increase overall over the course of those 7 years, or about 2.4 points per year, which is incredibly ambitious and hopefully sends a sense of urgency that gaps that have persisted need to close, and this is a driver of that. An existing goal that you may be familiar with is Minnesota's four-year graduation rate goal. We have a goal, and we've been, again, providing every district their performance relative to this goal on an annual basis to reach a 90% graduation rate, a four-year graduation rate, by the year 2020 with no group below 85. And so if we were to look at where we were in graduation rates in 2016, this is within 4 years by the year 2020, about an 8 percentage point increase, or about 2 percentage points per year to reach that 2020 goal. And that's for students overall. Of course, our lower performing student groups, the way these goals are set, accelerated progress would be needed for those groups to close gaps and meet, again, those consistent expectations. Minnesota will establish a seven-year graduation rate a goal to reach a seven-year graduation rate of 100 by the year 2025, a bit of a longer-term goal than our four-year rate. The seven-year rate does give some students more time, maybe some new-to-country students that are English learners, maybe some of our at-risk students, and particularly our a subset of special education students. We've heard so often about this, that are entitled to education until age 21, may not receive a diploma until age 21, and they, in the seven-year rate, which we will report and we will have this statewide goal on, and we'll look at performance of every school, they will be able to be captured in graduation rates. It may be an issue that some of you are familiar with, and certainly something that we've heard pretty consistently. The progress towards English language proficiency goal actually will be set here by the time that our plan is released, when data is released on August 7th, which is just 6 days after the public posting of our plan. But we are looking at a new access assessment. We only have 2 years of that assessment, and so we really need to look at progress between 2016 and 2017 in order to set that goal in a really meaningful way. And so you can expect to see that goal established here in the near future. We did choose as a state, because this was a high priority among stakeholders, to focus on consistent attendance. I'm going to talk about that as an indicator in a minute as well. But we did set a statewide goal around consistent attendance, which is actually the opposite of chronic absenteeism. Maybe some of you are familiar with the term chronic absenteeism, which is a student that is missing 10% or more of their days enrolled. So a consistent attendee would actually be a student that is in attendance at least 90% of their days enrolled. Because this decision document was released, it's dated June 15th, we have since, and you likely saw it in the plan, since set a goal around consistent attendance to reach a consistent attendance rate of 95% with no student group below 90. Again, setting that floor for performance, but raising the bar for that overall student group. This would be about a 7 percentage point increase from our current overall consistent attendance rate of about 83% or so. I'm going to now flip to the front page. And I'll talk through the indicators that you see on the left-hand side of this page. First of all, I wanted to make it clear, because I don't think it's clear in this document. It's so hard to get all information in a one-page front-to-back, plain language, concise resource, right, for people. But I want to make it very clear that it's required and it's right to report student group performance on every single one of these indicators. And so every single school, every single district in the state will have the performance on these indicators reported for every single student group. So while we have to, because when we're identifying schools for all of their student groups, I'll talk about how we kind of combine groups in a minute, but because we have to do that to look at overall school performance, it's also important to note that every school, we will know where every group is for their students of color, their students with disabilities, their English learners, and their students in poverty as well. So indicator number one is academic achievement, and that is in math and in reading. Right now, science was not a recommendation among stakeholders to include, but we could use science for school recognition. I'll talk about school recognition at the end of the presentation. This academic achievement indicator uses a proficiency index rate, which assigns half of a point to students that are partially proficient and a full point to students that are proficient. We still report, we have to, and again, it's the right thing to do, is reporting percent of students that are proficient in the school. And so those are two different indicators that can be used around proficiency, one that includes partially proficient kids as a half a point, and one that provides that transparency around percent proficient. The one within the accountability system is the proficiency index rate. There is a requirement in ESSA that our accountability system include participation on assessments. And within indicator one is where we are planning in our draft plan right now to embed that participation rate requirement. So any student that we're taking a pretty strong stance on this one, and any student that does not participate in the required assessments will count equivalent to not meeting academic standards. The law requires 95% of students participate. We're raising that, because it is a requirement that all students do take the test, to that 100%. So any student that does not participate in the assessment will be similar to not meeting standards. This really emphasizes the value of taking the assessments, particularly now we heard from stakeholders that the MCA can be used for course placement in MNSCU. And just the indicator of the MCA result as a predictor of needing developmental coursework in post-secondary. So really tying that value to that assessment, particularly for high school students. It also does aid in interpretation of results. Across all schools, every student that doesn't take the test is considered not proficient. Indicator 2 is academic progress. Some of you may be aware we had a lot of really good conversations with stakeholders about academic progress. We will be shifting from a relative normative growth model to one that is grounded in the standards and based on whether students are moving towards proficiency on the state assessments. And so this is a growth to proficiency model using what's called the transition matrix model, which assigns points for students that are moving forward. Of course, more points are assigned to students that are moving up multiple achievement levels. Indicator 3 is graduation rates, and we will look at a 4-year rate and a 7-year rate, but prioritizing that 4-year rate. And so I'll show you in a minute sort of the order of indicators to identify schools for support. But the 4-year rate is first. We check that. If the school is low on 4-year rate, then we look at the longer-term 7-year rate. The 4, 5, 6, and 7-year graduation rate will be reported for all schools and districts. Indicator 4 is the progress towards English language proficiency indicator. And this is a new one. What ESSA did was it shifted the Title III accountability system, which was very much separate for English learners, into holding all schools in the state accountable for the performance of their English language learners, which sends a really clear message that English language learners are for everybody to support. English language learners are not in the separate accountability system for educators to separately support. This is also a growth to proficiency measure. And so we will be looking at, based on starting level and grade, whether English learners are on a trajectory to become proficient over a certain number of years. And so, again, it's both our academic growth model and our English language development growth model are growth to standard, growth to proficiency models, which is a shift from what we've done. Indicator 5 is our school quality or student success indicator. This is one that received a lot of attention under ESSA as states are looking to include other measures, other non-test-based and graduation rate measures into their accountability systems. And here we're looking at using consistent attendance, again, which is the inverse of chronic absenteeism, as a starting point for the first round of identification, which would be in 2018. With a really clear desire and plan, desire among stakeholders and plan on our behalf to continue to build out our data systems so that we can move towards what some would consider more meaningful measures of well-rounded education, really looking at equitable participation in a well-rounded education, and some college and career and college readiness measures as well. And so this was an area that we had many conversations and a whole subcommittee with stakeholders working on. So looking at consistent attendance is a really solid indicator based on research, and this has been used across the country in ESSA plans, an indicator of student engagement in school climate in the short term while wanting to move towards more robust measures. I'm going to flip forward. This is not in the decision document, but it's in your PowerPoint. And this is the visual that we have today. We are working to refine this based on input. So open to hearing thoughts, but I just wanted, we wanted something to share with you all today, and this is all our best thinking in collaboration with stakeholders, but just know that our communications team is working diligently on visuals and things to really explain the system in a clear, transparent, kind of user-friendly way. This is a shift from our current multiple measurements rating system, in that it is not a summative rating that combines indicators into one overall composite score. This is a more innovative approach that we talked through with stakeholders, and one that allows us to very transparently report how every single school, again, every single student group, is doing on every indicator in the accountability system. Sometimes when you do an overall composite score, you can mask low performance or high performance on individual indicators. And so this is a transparent way to say, here's how you're doing on all 5 of those indicators that I just walked through in your school for students overall and for every student group. So I also want to mention, too, it does lend itself well, Greg's going to talk about this, to the school improvement process and the needs assessment process. Instead of schools having to peel back many layers of, for example, the MMR, they can really clearly see how they're doing and where their challenge areas are on every indicator in order to identify those root causes, set goals, establish strategies, and build their improvement plan for raising student achievement and closing gaps. So it lends itself very well to the school improvement process that Greg will talk through. And then it also does allow us to include new school quality student success indicators in the future without a complete overhaul of a summative rating or composite score. So it's a more seamless approach to building to the system that stakeholders wanted to build to by being able to include those new school quality student success indicators around well-rounded education and career and college readiness in the future, planning for the year 2021. So just a couple comments on this process, and one that you likely will see is innovative and is very different from what many are used to.
So, Ms. Graff, if I may interrupt you there, I envision a rectangle around this configuration you have formed so that all students are considered. What is your thought on what will happen as far as elementary and middle school identification for the rest of the students who are not in Title I, Stage 1, 2, or 3?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. And actually, the Commissioner has asked for us to work on visuals that are focused on the non-Title I schools that will be identified, because that's a critical part of ESSA. And that's a critical part of alignment with World's Best Workforce, where we include all schools in the state. And so this visual shows the process, but non-Title I schools are a part of this school identification as well.
Madam Chair, there's actually two levels of support that we're able to give to schools. One is for the comprehensive level of support, which Greg will talk about in depth, and that's the bottom 5% of schools. But there's another level of support that we give to schools that are consistently underperforming in any student group, and those are called targeted assistance schools. And literally, that could be many of our schools. I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of our schools will need support in at least some component. Might be for ELL kids in reading, or it could be students with disabilities in math. So we'll know specifically where that support is, and that's why this model lends itself so nicely to our student support strategies that Greg will discuss in a little bit.
And Ms. Graff, one more question.
And that's the targeted support is for all schools.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Graff, on indicator 3, the graduation rate, when you go to the 5, 6, and 7-year rates, are those students going to be enrolled in regular high school then, or are you going to be looking at alternative programs and those programs that we have outside the regular classroom as we would see it for the high school 9-12? Ms. Graff.
Madam Chair, that expectation, that indicator, is for every single school in the state. Every high school that serves a 12th grader that is eligible for a graduation rate would have that 4-year, 5-year, 6-year, and 7-year, as long as they meet cell size requirements, graduation rate. Something I didn't mention, and I can't believe I forgot this because it's really, really important, is it's on the bottom right of the decision document, but it's really the focus around high schools that we're seeing in ESSA that we didn't see in No Child Left Behind,
right,
and that we didn't see in our waiver, which is that any high school in the state with a 4-year graduation rate overall or for any student group that's below 67%, so they're graduating fewer than 2/3 of their kids, is identified for comprehensive support and improvement. Minnesota took the commissioner took a really firm stance on this one in collaboration with stakeholders as well, probably a higher bar than we're seeing in some other states by, one, using a 4-year graduation rate and not an extended year rate. On-time graduation is the primary goal for all kids. So that's one. And secondly, looking at student group graduation rates. We could have done, per the law, an overall graduation rate requirement, but that doesn't mean that a school isn't failing for some student group. So I wanted to mention that as well.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just briefly talk through maybe the decision process, and I know the Commissioner has to go, so I want to make sure that there's opportunity for questions there. This is the process that will be used for Title I schools, but then it will be replicated for the targeted support and improvement schools that include both non-Title I and Title I. So first we would start with our overall pool of all Title I schools, and elementary and middle schools use the same process. High schools use a bit of a different, same process, different indicators. So we would look at our overall pool of Title I schools. Any school that is low in the bottom quarter in math achievement, reading achievement, or English language proficiency moves on. So you could be, a school could be low in one or two or three of those indicators, and that school moves on into the eligibility pool for identification for support. A school could be high in math, low in reading, and high in English language proficiency, and that reading low proficiency gets that school to continue on to eligibility. So that's the importance of keeping these indicators separate, because one indicator can get that school moving forward and into an identification for support. The order of these indicators also establishes the weight. Some of you may be familiar with the weighting in ESSA. Greater relative weight is given to the indicators that are first. And so the primary indicators are, in this model, math achievement, reading achievement, English language proficiency, and those are first. Those are that's the first cut, the first expectation. So those schools move on to, again, in the pool of eligibility. And then we do another check, and now we look at growth. And looking at student progress is so important because students may not be reaching that proficiency bar, but they may be demonstrating growth towards proficiency on our growth model. And so we look at any school that moved on to stage two that is low in math progress or reading progress. And again, you could be high in one, low in another, and you still move on. And then the final stage is the lowest weighting indicator, which is consistent attendance. So any school that is in the bottom five, that's where we do our bottom 5%. Any school that is in the bottom 5% of Title I schools for consistent attendance would be identified for support. I did want to mention that we've run a lot of data and done a lot of analyses, but that final cut for consistent attendance, when we look at academic performance for those schools, what we're seeing is that the schools that move on and are identified for the bottom 5% are performing far lower than our schools that are actually bumping out of that third cut of consistent attendance. So we're really getting schools that are low across proficiency or English language proficiency, growth, and consistent attendance to be able to focus our support on those schools that need it the most, given our capacity through the regional centers. With that, for the targeted support improvement schools, we would look at any school in the state, non-Title I or Title I, every single student group, and we would run it through the same process to identify those schools that are consistently underperforming, and that's a term that's used in the law. But we would say, here's a non-Title I school. That school, I'm just giving an example, that non-Title I school has a black student group, and we're going to check if that black student group is lower than the 25th percentile at stage one, lower than the 25th percentile at stage two on either of those indicators, and lower than the cutoff for consistent attendance to identify the bottom 5%. So that's where a key equity piece comes in, that we're looking at all schools in the state and their student group performance through this funnel. There's one other targeted support and improvement identification, and that looks at schools with any student group, again, any student group at all, that is performing like the bottom 5%, and that's where we would compare to the average of the bottom 5% of schools. So there's a couple ways to look at student group performance to make sure that we're really catching and able to focus our supports to those schools that maybe overall are not falling in the bottom but have a student group that needs some support. I don't think I'm going to talk through the high school example. I think it's so similar to the elementary and middle. What it does is it replaces the four-year rate and the seven-year rate with academic progress. There is not an academic progress indicator at the high school level. Stakeholders felt that because we give the assessment in 10th and 11th, 10th for reading, 11th grade for math, that looking at growth between 8th grade and, for example, 11th grade math, there's too much that can happen in between there for us to really use that as a valid measure of high school student progress. So they felt that graduation should be kind of in place of that.
So, Ms. Graff, I have a question, though, looking at the high school identification process.
Okay.
So we've walked through stage one, stage two, stage 2B, and stage three, but it seems to me that if students are showing up, then it's not going to be a low-performing high school. Is that correct? You know, if the consistent attendance is in place, that school might not be low-performing because it has reached that. So this is a little confusing to me, and I have made a comment on my comment sheet, so I don't know if you want to consider that now or wait with that. But
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly touch on it maybe. So you're right that stage three is a check. These are all thresholds, right? So that stage three is a check. If a school is high enough there, they would not fall into the bottom 5%. I can tell you for high schools, right now, given our Title I schools, 5% of high schools is about 7 high schools in the state, so right. Very few. Every single one of those 7 in our data runs right now are already identified for low graduation rates and already would receive that comprehensive support and improvement. And so even if a school at that final threshold is high enough in attendance, expectation for graduation rates would still get them that support.
So, Ms. Graff, that low-performing school would not exit this designation simply because they improved their attendance. Ms. Graff?
Madam Chair, yes, in our data runs thus far, every school that falls in the bottom is already identified for low graduation rates. But there still is that threshold, right? There's still that these are filters. And so these are hard checks, and if a school falls below, they move on. If they don't, they're out. Something that we've heard from stakeholders, and I think it's really important to do, is to report how every school is doing relative to these thresholds, because a school could be, this is the nature of percentiles, a school could be in the 26th percentile, right? And so they're not reaching that threshold to get them to continue on. But that school needs to know they're in the 26th percentile. Communities need to know they're in the 26th percentile because that's something to pay attention to. Because when we identify again, if they don't progress and improve, they could find themselves right below that threshold. So that comes to the importance of the reporting conversation as well.
Ms. Graff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a kind of an idea of the scope of the number of high schools that we're talking about, and Greg will talk a bit about high school supports in a minute, but the number of high schools we're talking about in the state that would be identified through ESSA in our early modeling is around 200 or so that have at least a student group that is below that 67% graduation rate. Many of them are for traditionally lower performing and groups that have lower graduation rates. And so this is a real firm stance on equity and making sure that all kids cross that finish line and receive a diploma.
Senator Clausen, is your question relevant now?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question about the graduation rate. Currently we have students, special needs students, that oftentimes go into transition programs and they're counted as non-graduates. And that's always been a little bit of a sore spot. And I'm just wondering, how are we going to deal with that so it's misleading for the real graduation rate, because they've met the requirements for graduation. Now they're moving on to a transition program. I would assume they'd be counted in the 4 or the 5, 6, 7, but they're counted against the graduation rate. Can you comment on how to resolve that issue so you really are providing accurate information?
Ms. Graff, good question, Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair, Senator Clausen, I'll take this question because I'm also very passionate about this issue and have brought it to the federal OSEP agencies at the Department of Ed, because it's not fair that students that need services beyond high school Transition Plus services are not getting those services because high school principals may feel as though they're going to take a hit on their four-year graduation rate. But they said they would not allow that. But then on the other hand, they're also not allowing states like Tennessee to give special diplomas, like a special ed diploma. So somehow we need to resolve this issue. And so I think I may have talked with you previously, or Senator Kent, about this, where something in the state funding system could could help us here, where we still allow schools to get funded even though the federal government is not allowing us to include them in the four-year graduation rate, so that then we won't see our numbers decrease for students that need to see to get Transition Plus services. And so I'm still trying to push on that one, and I will with the new secretary as well, because I don't think it's fair. Another area that I don't think is fair and still is not going to be included even in our seven or eight year rate is GED. So students can earn a GED. The GED is much more challenging and difficult and aligned to our standards now, college and career ready standards, but that too cannot be considered in the graduation rate, the extended graduation rate. And I think if, you know, adult ed programs are doing work, we have a new adult diploma program that we've been doing, somehow it seems we should be able to count those students. So when we see Minnesota getting a number three for education and diplomas, and how many of our adults have diplomas, and it's a 92% of adults in Minnesota have a high school diploma or equivalency, that's because they're counting these other measures, GED. So,
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would look forward to working with you on that issue, because it is as a former high school principal, it's always been an issue that I've been concerned about. I've just got another quick question. I've always been concerned about the requirements for English language learners to take the assessments given the limited time they've been in the United States. Have we addressed that at all in the ESSA plan?
Ms. Nguyen, please introduce yourself for the record and then answer the question.
Good afternoon. Wayne Nguyen, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. We engaged with stakeholders on that. There was a provision in ESSA that did provide us two options. One option was to not test newly arrived English learners the first year. And then the second option was to test them that first year, and not include the test scores, though, within the accountability system. But by testing them the first year, you would then would be able to measure their growth the second year and then measure their proficiency in the third year. As the commissioner mentioned, we did have an EL committee that did tackle this, and we have brought the question to the committee. And I won't say it was a consensus recommendation, but we did receive a recommendation that yes, these newly arrived students should be tested that first year so that we can measure the growth and the proficiency.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Clausen. Senator Hoffman, relevant to this?
Absolutely,
thank
Madam
you.
Chair. Thank you, and I think this is going to pose a series of questions, but I want to be brief. And Senator Clausen, thanks for bringing up the issue of the youth with disabilities, because in 66, when Title VI was added to this Elementary Secondary Education Act, they were specifically looking at that. And I've yet to hear you talk about that except in one statement. And so I guess what prompts my question, Madam Chair, and this is something we could follow up later, because I'm just as perplexed as you are on some of the presentations. Maybe we need more time on that. But two things. Number one was your statement. And number two was when Ms. Graff, you made a comment about growth model to proficiency or growth model to standards. I had a moment of shock in thinking that I just got back from a conference where we talked about emerging leadership when it comes to education and addressing some of the issues that you're talking about. And my question to you is, if you start to see more competency-based platforms out there, and you see the differentiated instruction models that you've heard about for many years out there, and you talk about flexible learning for a child, that really fits to more of a growth model than anything else. And so I guess the question is, did I misunderstand you when you said growth to proficiency or growth to standard, meaning we're going to get less flexible in our approach, right? And if we're not truly looking at the individualized needs of a child, how is this going to address specifically? It's related to Greg's question, Senator Clausen's questions. It's always related to the fact that there is a little bit of confusion on how is this going to be flexible to the unique and individualized needs of a child and their disability and how it affects their education.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question. The growth to proficiency model, and again, this was discussed at length with stakeholders, We'll look at every single student and all student groups and whether they are moving towards meeting standards. The conversation was really around informing instruction for educators and really around deeply implementing Minnesota's academic standards and taking a very close look at implementation of standards across the state to make sure that our students with disabilities have equitable access to the standards and are moving again on those achievement levels, that our students in poverty, our students of color, but that all kids have that access to instruction that is moving them on the Minnesota standards. There was conversation about being able to use, many are unfamiliar with the achievement level descriptors, which tell educators exactly, if a student is not meeting standards or partially meeting standards or meeting or exceeding, exactly what that means on the standards and informative to them on their instruction. So that was the basis of the conversation, really looking at grounding this not in how are students doing compared to one another, but grounding this in Minnesota standards that you all have adopted and have been developed in with significant collaboration among stakeholders as well.
Senator Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it still begs the question about the flexibility, and when you're looking at the differentiated instruction side of it and the growth model, it's like there's still a missing gap, and I can't wrap my fingers around it yet. And I don't have 5 hours today because I don't want Representative Erickson saying, Hoffman, you held this up, and that's not okay. So I'm going to withhold, and hopefully this will flush out because I know the Commissioner, Madam Chair, has got to go someplace. But I do have some more questions which I can follow up on later. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, remember you can submit comments to the Commissioner, to any one of her team, as I'm going to, with concerns. We can't cover everything today because, as you can tell, this is a very large undertaking and there's no way we can talk about all of the specifics. So please keep that in mind because I know that the team would welcome that and they will receive several from me. So please do that. And Senator Hoffman, I would appreciate it if you do that too. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to our Chief Academic Officer.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Please say your name for the record, Mr. Keith.
Greg Keith, Chief Academic Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about the school improvement work, and I will attempt to be brief because this is a topic that could be talked about in some depth. So I'm going to hit some of the high points. Really, in the school improvement work, and the planning around the S estate plan, around school improvement, two of the Minnesota pieces of context that we really wanted to work from and work with were World's Best Workforce legislation and World's Best Workforce activities that districts engage in, and the Regional Centers of Excellence, which you know we've used to support districts for about 5 years now. We will use the World's Best Workforce. One of the changes we'll make to how the regional centers work with schools is through World's Best Workforce, we'll be shifting our focus from school-level supports to district-level supports so that we can better leverage World's Best Workforce activities to improve schools and so that we can create more sustainability. This is also in alignment with new requirements under ESSA that districts have more responsibility around school improvement than states. We've also aligned interventions so that as we're working with districts under World's Best Workforce that aren't making progress at the district level, we're aligning those interventions that we're using with districts to the same types of interventions that we're using with schools. We will support schools, specifically schools identified under ESSA. We'll support schools identified under ESSA in one of two ways. To districts with high proportions of schools identified for comprehensive support and improvement or targeted support and improvement, which has already been talked about, we'll make direct grants to districts so that they can fund school improvement activities and differentiate activities for their schools. We'll still work in partnership with them, but we'll directly fund those districts to engage in school improvement activities with their schools. For smaller districts, or districts that don't have a high proportion of schools identified for support, for charter schools, we'll provide direct services to those schools to support their school improvement activities through the Regional Centers of Excellence. we have created a differentiated model that the regional centers will use, starting with prioritizing the highest levels of support for schools that are in districts that aren't making, for identified schools that are in districts that aren't making progress in the world's best workforce. And it was the stakeholders' theory of action there that this would be a situation where not only is the district struggling at the systems level, but then the schools are struggling at the school level, classroom level. And so that this is a place where we need to intervene with our most with most resources. So that will be our highest level of support. Next is the commissioner and as Stephanie have talked about. They talked about schools identified for comprehensive support and improvement. This would be that bottom 5%, and this would be those high schools that are identified for graduation rates under 67%. Those would receive the next highest level of support directly from the regional centers. And then we have our targeted support and improvement schools, which would receive the lightest level of support, but that support would be directly to the district so that the district can in turn support the schools. In terms of numbers, this will be, under ESSA, we'll be working with a much higher number of schools through the regional centers. We'll be working with, at the comprehensive support level, probably about, on our initial runs, approximately just under 250 schools, about 200 high schools, as was previously shared, and then just a little more than 50 schools that are identified in the bottom 5%. So this will be a significantly larger pool of schools than we're used to working with under our waiver. Under the targeted support and improvement level, we're looking at also another about 250 schools. So this will be quite a change for our model. And so we're having to make some significant changes to how we allocate resources and how we serve schools to support school improvement. A couple of changes to what the regional centers actually do with schools, and I'll be really brief and run through these, and I am happy to follow up with more information. One thing we'll be doing under ESSA and in our work with stakeholders is we've significantly increased the role of needs assessment. Our current needs assessment model mainly looks at student performance data, which, as you know, is only one indicator of looking at where a school's at. So we'll be beefing up our needs assessment process, and very specifically in our needs assessment process, one thing that we'll be doing under ESSA is we'll be looking at inequities. Inequities in terms of how resources are allocated, resources are used, human capital is used, teacher talent is used. And so this will be a significant addition to our needs assessment process when schools are identified. We will be producing a list of evidence-based turnaround practices. It will be a non-exhaustive list, so schools and districts will not have to choose from this list. But one of the requirements under ESSA, a new significant bar for school turnaround, is school improvement plans have to include at least one evidence-based practice, and ESSA clearly defines what evidence-based means. And so the state will do a lot of that work for schools and districts and produce a list of evidence-based practices that they can choose from but don't have to choose from. That list will be, so getting to Stephanie and her comment about the transparency and how the identification system, the funnel, if you will, give schools specific information about where they're underperforming and why they were identified. That list will be organized according to reading, math, chronic absenteeism, so that schools can then use that information to select appropriate interventions for their school improvement plans. We will move from a one-year school improvement cycle to a three-year school improvement cycle with a planning year, an exploration and installation year, as we're calling it, during the first year, and then two-year school improvement plans. And part of the logic for that is that we can expand the needs assessment, which I've already talked about, and also that would bring it in line with our World's Best Workforce three-year cycle. So that was conversation amongst stakeholders of another way to align the school improvement supports and activities with World's Best Workforce and those supports. High schools will be a new audience for us under school support and under school improvement. So that will be a significant change. As I said, we'll have about 200 high schools. Currently, we don't work with any high schools. under the current waiver system. So that will be a new piece. Stakeholders had a lot of conversation about appropriate interventions for high schools, and one of the most important interventions and supports that they want us to offer to high schools is our Minnesota Early Indicator and Response System, which is a dropout, early dropout identification, so it identifies kids who are at risk of not graduating in 4 years. So a big piece of our school improvement work with high schools will be around dropout prevention. We have significantly increased the requirements and the supports for schools that don't meet exit criteria and are identified again. That was not one of the stronger pieces of our waiver and our school improvement work under the waiver, but under the ESSA plan, we've significantly beefed up how we'll look at schools and how we'll support schools at a higher level when they fail to meet exit criteria and they're identified again. And just echoing the commissioner's comment that many of these schools currently our priority schools were priority schools the first time, and they'll be identified for comprehensive support if that happened here. So that's also a significant ratcheting up, if you will, under ESSA. Want to just comment that this is a lot of work. Our regional center staff are really scared of all this increased work, stakeholders really gave them a high bar and a lot of change. ESSA defined a lot of that, and the stakeholders really had a high standard for school improvement and were really passionate. I think they were the most interested and involved. I think some other project teams might disagree. But we've currently established eight project teams, or are establishing eight project teams to engage in this work that I've outlined. They'll be working through the course of next school year to prepare the resources, the processes, the protocols that we'll begin to use with schools. The only other comment I would offer is during next school year, we'll still be supporting the same focus of priority schools. And so we'll also be reaching out to districts not making progress under World's Best Workforce to begin supports for them. And we'll also do some initial reach out and some initial supports to schools that, based on previous data, we know have a graduation rate under 67% and might very likely be identified in 2018. We want to go ahead and engage in some work with them, build some relationships with them, so that we can go ahead and leverage some of these activities immediately instead of waiting a year. So, thank you.
So, Mr. Keith, thank you for your presentation. How are parents going to understand why a school is being marked for improvement? How are they going to know this? What's going to indicate that for them?
Okay. Two ways. Do you want me to answer this?
Yeah.
Okay. Madam Chair, sorry. Two ways. First of all, there are some specific parent notification requirements in ESSA in terms of plain languaging notifications to parents and information to parents about schools that are identified for support and why they were identified for support. The second response is there's some very specific and different and higher level requirements under ESSA for involving stakeholders, communities, and parents in this whole process with districts and schools. So parents have to be involved under the requirements of the federal law in the school improvement planning, needs assessment, and implementation.
And finally, Mr. Keith, how much will this cost? Sounds like the regional centers, as you said, you've set a high bar. They're scared. Obviously, that's going to take more funding. So any estimates, or maybe the commissioner wants to respond for what this is going to cost?
Madam Chair, we have the opportunity under ESSA to leverage school improvement dollars, and we currently get about 4% of the title funding at the department to leverage for school improvement. Now, that's used in regional centers. It's some of that, most of that's flow through, I believe, to our cooperatives who administer our regional centers of excellence, and they're great partners. And then now under ESSA, we'll be able to leverage 7% of that. So we'll be using additional funding to be able to leverage so that we can support these schools. And I think the reason that we're scared is, you know, we've come before this body a number of times asking for more funding for regional centers simply because it's a really good model. It works alongside schools. It's time intensive. It's staff intensive to have and build those deep relationships with teachers and with school leaders and do the kind of work in the way that it can be sustainable in the long run rather than, okay, everybody come to Roseville. Let's, you know, hold a meeting and then you go back and implement it. This is actually on the ground coaching, cognitive coaching, training, working through your needs assessment, data analytics, data review, timely feedback, and it's just it's working alongside school leaders, and then when they exit a gentle release, where the support is still there within the region, at the local community cooperative that we're partnering with local experts that the community knows. So that's the model, and that's just, it's costly. So there is additional resources that are needed to do it right, in my opinion, but we'll do it the best that we can with what we have now. I do think we have the opportunity, Madam Chair, to also work with school districts who are not meeting their world's best workforce goals, obviously, and in that legislation, the opportunity to set aside up to 2% of that funding for school districts that aren't meeting their local goals. And so I would assume that many school districts will have local goals that they are not meeting, and we'll be able to work with them on that funding as well. And leverage QComp, leverage American Indian funding, leverage our EL funding, leverage our literacy aid, leverage compensatory, leverage, you know, all of those categorical aids. How are you spending those dollars and prioritizing those dollars on the strategies that are going to get you the best advancement for children? And I think that that's the key of the world's best workforce legislation, and that's what I've shared with this committee over and over and over again, and why it's so important. The world's best workforce is just the driver behind the real accountability, because that's $9 billion. And the federal program is $230 million. So I'm not sure. You want to make a comment on some other funding?
I was just going to say we have done some work to look at to sustain our current model, or a variation of our current model for this increased number of schools. We would be, our estimate when we began to ballpark and look at human capital that would be needed was about an additional $8 million of state funding. So back to the commissioner's comment, we do what we can with what we have.
But we need what he said.
Yeah, we're pretty sure we'll hear from you. These are very ambitious goals, team. So, you know, I appreciate your focus on proficiency, your purposeful attempt, especially Mr. Keith, to align with the world's best workforce, because you've heard me talk about how important that is since we have it in law. You're consulting with stakeholders. But I think that, you know, what I'm not reading in the plan, and I know it's still somewhat in its infant stage, but more focus on student outcomes, empowering local districts and charters, and, you know, providing meaningful school performance feedback to parents in particular, and then our teachers, very important, and then ultimately our taxpayers. So I hope that when you go back to the drawing board now, that you will work on making sure that this is not seen as such a compliance model, but a way to help our teachers know how to help our students, and for our parents to know how to help their children and know that they're making progress toward a world-class education, which has always been our goal. So I imagine, Commissioner, you probably have to leave, and we have to finish the PowerPoint so we can move on to testifiers, because we have a good 30 minutes of testifying needed. Representative McQuaid, do you have a question before we move on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I love our schools. I went to the schools I represent now, but I am recognizing more and more that a lot of the things we're asking schools to address are not education-based, but there are things that we don't deal with as a legislature. And I, as specifically when we're talking about chronic absenteeism, our district has identified that mental health for students and parents is actually the largest contributing factor to chronic absenteeism for students. Now, sure, we can do stuff in schools for students, but not for parents. And so if we're getting to a place where we're seeing some of these out-of-school factors that with all of these dollars we can leverage and all of these regional center solutions that can't fix it because it's not education-based, are those things that you can bring back to us as a legislature and tell us, this is as much as we can do with what we have in a school, we need to do this outside of school now?
Mr. Keith, want to take that or not?
Madam Chair, we can do that. And just a reflection I would offer on your question and your request is, I mentioned evidence-based practices. One of the few that has a significant amount of evidence is this concept of full-service community schools. And I know we had some grants that were funded previously. And some of the schools that we've worked with through that grant program have been schools identified for support. And we have seen a school in Minneapolis comes to mind as an example that turned around, and had we re-identified schools last year, would have been a reward school instead of a priority school. And when you talk to that principal, who is, of course, the architect of this turnaround, one of the main strategies that he references is that they were given this full-service community schools grant. So just reiterating exactly your observation that we need wraparound services for students and teachers and kids to support school turnaround and student progress and achievement.
And MDE staff, I think we're going to need you to return probably later in August, you know, to clear up some of the questions that we've asked and some of the comments that you're going to receive from us. So do look forward to probably hearing more from us. We want clarity, we want transparency, and we really want to focus on the reporting system that parents are going to look at. And I know there's no model included in the plan, but I think that'll be in the next stage. So do look forward to that. I think we have to move to English learners now. Ms. Nguyen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will keep this brief because I know that we are running short on time, and I think Ms. Graff answered a lot or included a lot of in her presentation, and Senator Claussen asked actually a question that is in the decisions document about testing and when we test for newly arrived English learners. So what I just want to reiterate is that this is one area where we actually do see a lot of great opportunities, and really, again, as Ms. Graff said, bringing English learners and those students into this accountability system so that school districts and schools really do see this as this is everyone. We all have to work together to meet the needs of English learners. We had a great committee. We had teachers, we had EL coordinators, we had community members, parents. We held focus groups with students. I will just say the EL team at the Department of Education, they are really, really passionate. We've developed some great relationships with our community partners, and we will continue doing this work because we've identified through this process other things that we will have to do. One last thing I think I just want to touch on that wasn't touched on as part of any of the other presentations is the requirement in ESSA for us to have standard entrance and exit criteria for identification of English learner students. And this really is, Minnesota has been a leader in this through the LEAPS legislation that was passed a few years ago. So I think Minnesota was really ahead of many other states in this, but ESSA gave us an opportunity again to kind of really look at the system and really listen to the community and identify some areas in which we can improve the process. What we learned was that really there wasn't consistency throughout the state on how school districts were identifying English learners. So we will have a consistent screening tool that districts will use, and consistent expectations and consistent training to school staff to first identify these English learner students. Because what we heard from parents and community members is that they had different experiences depending if they moved to a different district. And then, really, again, just starting at the very beginning of the process, every single family has to fill out a home language survey. And what we heard really was that that the form didn't tell families very much about why they were filling out the form. They didn't understand the services that could be provided to the families if they were identified as an English learner. They didn't understand that everyone had to fill this out. So again, really working intentionally with community members, educators, we redid the entire form to provide clear and more understandability about what this is, what the EL system, and what kind of services that we could provide. And then again, looking at Minnesota-specific data on how our English learners are doing on the WIDA access test, and again, ensuring that there's consistency and understandability as to what proficiency you have to achieve to be exited out of EL services. So I do think that there are great opportunities, and Minnesota has really embraced the opportunities under the English learner provisions under the law, and I hope you see that throughout the state plan.
Thank you, Ms. Green. And members, I do encourage you to read through the plan. You know, sometimes this is inside baseball. We understand this. I hope the public can. But the department has really done a deep dive on ELL, and I think you will really appreciate some of their narrative here and the hope for us to improve for those learners. Are we moving on to educator quality now? That's another good section I found in the plan. I appreciate that very much.
I like the school improvement section. Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Sure.
In fact, I've heard it called a masterpiece.
And I'm sure Ms. Graff would like accountability and assessment, so.
Madam Chair.
Excuse my personal. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, I can be really brief on the educator quality because what the stakeholder groups in partnership with us did to meet the requirements in ESSA under educator quality, we basically leveraged the requirements under World's Best Workforce.
Yes.
Under ESSA, districts and states and schools are required to look at, are any groups of students disproportionately served by inexperienced teachers, ineffective teachers, or teachers teaching out of field? And as you know, our World's Best Workforce legislation has some requirements for districts to look at which teachers are teaching which kids, are effective teachers teaching the kids who are most in need, and also to diversify their teacher workforce. And so basically in the ESSA plan, we're choosing to leverage, and stakeholders wanted us to leverage, the World's Best Workforce requirements to meet the federal requirements. And so the state will play a supportive role in assisting districts with their local work under World's Best Workforce to ensure that all students have access to effective, experienced, and in-field teachers. Just two other very quick comments I'll make. One is we did have to define what an ineffective teacher is as part of our ESSA planning, and stakeholders chose to define ineffective teacher as someone not meeting professional standards as measured by local teacher evaluation systems. So we'll be working more with districts, continuing our work with districts, to ensure that they have good, robust, supportive teacher evaluation and development systems. We will also, second footnote, we will continue to report teacher data as we have always done so. So that will be something that we will continue in terms of levels of experience, degree attainment, in-field versus out-of-field, so that we'll still report data about teacher effectiveness at the state level for communities and for parents. And then we'll be supporting districts as they pursue this work under World's Best Workforce. I believe I have the next section, which is just
the funding.
A little bit on funding. Yeah. And we're focusing on new.
Senator Kent has a question before we move to funding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very briefly, I just wanted to go back to your point about the requirement to define an effective teacher. Was that part of the ESSA requirements?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I'm just going to hit, obviously, there's a lot of intricacies to funding under the federal law. So I'm just going to hit some of the new items that might be of interest. The commissioner already mentioned that the set aside for the state to support school improvement with state activities did go from 4% to 7%. I do want to offer just one observation about that. Even though that amount for state activities rises from 4% of our state Title I allocation to 7% of our state Title I allocation. We actually, schools and districts don't get any more money, because what the law did was they did away with the school improvement grant program. And so what they basically did was they raised our state activity money because they shut that program down. So I do just want to offer the observation that that's not necessarily new money for schools and districts and school improvement work. Under ESSA, the state can withhold 3% of the state Title I allocation for grants to schools and districts to provide direct student services. In our engagement with stakeholders, there was a recommendation for the state not to withhold that money, so we will not be withholding 3% to make competitive grants for direct student services to schools and districts. And I'll observe that most of the activities that would be targeted by that grant program are already allowable for schools and districts with their local formula Title I allocation. So this would not provide new opportunities for schools and districts, and this was what stakeholders observed. So that was a stakeholder recommendation. A new program under ESSA is states could use 3% of the Title I Title II allocation to support school leaders, principals, and other school leader positions. Previously, Title II focused pretty exclusively on teacher development, and so this is an exciting new opportunity. And so we're currently designing our model in consultation with some stakeholders. We have a project team that's getting underway with that. But currently, it looks like some of the key activities will be mentoring for new principals, networking opportunities for rural principals, and professional development specific to how to provide instructional feedback. A new program under ESSA is Title IV, Part A, which is...
And may I interrupt you, Mr. Keith, there before you leave principals? I hope in your narrative you'll mention that we fund the Principals Academy. That has been so successful, but I did not see it mentioned in the narrative, and maybe you're getting to that, but I would hope that would be added as a program that the legislature supports, because it really has improved our school leadership and will continue to do so in spite of this Title II designation. So please think about that as you proceed. Please go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then finally, the Title IV Part A grants. This is about a $4 million program. So this will be $4 million in grants to schools. It'll be a competitive grant program, and it really supports school programs in one of three areas: either offering students well-rounded educational opportunities, creating safe and healthy environments for students, or instructional technology and the use of technology. So that will be a new program that we are currently issuing the competitive RFP for to schools and districts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keith. And Ms. Nguyen, would you complete... We have about 3 minutes before we have to start testimony. The dates for public comment, et cetera.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. As you may be aware, we will officially be posting our ESSA state plan for public comment beginning August 1st, and we will be holding a series of public meetings to inform the public and to also gather input and feedback from the public. So as you can see, we do have three public meetings scheduled throughout the state in the month of August. In addition to these, I will say that we are going to different conferences, and we are accepting invitations from different associations to also present and speak about ESSA. So I would put that out there to any of the organizations here that we are more than happy to come as our team is able to speak on ESSA.
And to the public, to note that if they don't get their a say in today, that these meetings are available to them to express directly to you. Thank you.
And during the public comment period, we will have, an email address and a phone line in which we can also provide public comment. Thank you. Just wanted to let you know kind of the next steps as well. So we will be submitting the plan for public comment. After that, we are in the second round of states submitting our state plan to the U.S. Department of Education. It is due to them by September 18th. Once they've received our state plan, they have 120 days to review and approve our state plan. And then Title I and Title III are the ones that are going through peer review process, and then the other ones are just kind of going through programmatic review. And I'm going to hand this off to Stephanie.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief, but I think these are a few important points to make before we wrap up our presentation and move on to more testifiers. One, data reporting has come up in Madam Chair. You expressed the importance very clearly. The commissioner talked about it. I mentioned it in my remarks as well, but this is a big priority for MDE to collaborate with stakeholders and make sure that over the course of the next year, when we engage in dialogue with families and communities and educators about what they want to see for our data reporting system, that we're building something that is clear, that is transparent, that allows users to see a summary of how a school is doing and at a glance, kind of overall, but also allows those users to dive deeper where they want to dive deeper. We've heard clearly from stakeholders this is a priority, as it is for us as well. We've heard some clear themes and values, but really we're embarking on that work beginning really after the submission of our state plan over the course of the 17-18 school year to build what we've referred to as kind of this dashboard, which actually may be separate from the Minnesota report card, because the Minnesota report card is fairly compliance-based, and there are so many requirements from a federal standpoint about how that data can look and what needs to be included. So what we've heard is maybe we need to build a separate dashboard that is more user-friendly for parents and families. So that's a priority, a big part of our work over the next year. The school quality or student success indicator, I mentioned this, really wanting to move towards measures of well-rounded education, college and career readiness. A big part of that is increasing compliance for districts submitting through the Minnesota Common Core Catalog, which is really our main vehicle to understand student participation in courses throughout their pre-K through 12 career. Right now, about 46% of schools in the state we have data for through the Minnesota Common Core Catalog, which is a reason why we couldn't right now move to including that equitable access piece to well-rounded education. So that's a priority for us as well. The school recognition process we'll be working on, thinking about what are indicators that we can use to recognize high-performing schools and what does it look like to disseminate and share those practices and replicate those practices across the state. This is an area for opportunity to align with World's Best Workforce, which districts and schools are demonstrating success in the five areas of World's Best Workforce on the performance measures outlined in state law. Science inclusion, there's been a lot of ideas around what could be used to recognize high-performing schools. And the commissioner did touch on the further exploration needed for any assessment flexibilities in the future.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Minnesota Department of Education, for coming to us when I know the plan is still, as I said earlier, in its infant stages. I look forward to many major revisions and to a subsequent hearing in August. And Senator Pratt has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So now that we've gone through the whole plan and we've talked about what's in the Minnesota plan, it's my understanding that the Federal Department of Education has sent plans back to other states for revisions. Can you talk about the criteria that the Department of Education used to send those plans back and how you've addressed those specific criteria?
Ms. Graff.
Madam Chair, I can touch on this. We've been watching the process, as you can imagine. As some of you may know, and I'll try to be brief here, in March, the President signed the regulations that the Obama administration put into effect. And so what that meant is that we were really, left with, and rightly so, left the law, and having to make sure that we're building a plan that is compliant with the ESSA law, as we had been doing all along with stakeholders. But we didn't have that additional sort of regulatory piece to guide some of the work and support some of the decisions. We've been watching the process. The peer review criteria, Wei mentioned that Title I and Title III are going through the peer review process. What we've seen is some inconsistencies in the feedback that's going back to states. Some would consider overreach on behalf of the department with defining ambitious goals, defining how science can be included in very specific ways, defining career and college readiness and the use of advanced placement and IB. And so we're watching some of these things. What we've seen is that in the feedback, states across the country, there are 16 that have submitted, are not receiving consistent responses and are not receiving consistent requests. And part of that may be the nature of the peer review process. But we do have the opportunity to continue to watch that process. We've only seen the early stages of that, really. So we'll continue to monitor that as states continue to get feedback. Not all states have received feedback in it, even. I know Congress is closely watching this, too. Maybe some of you were aware yesterday there was a large hearing on early implementation of ESSA. So we're trying to stay engaged in that conversation to hopefully inform our work over the course of the next 6 weeks or so before we are... 2 months or so before we submit in September.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment about the school recognition process. So often we recognize a school, but we forget about the people that actually made that happen. So I hope, in you're looking at recognition, you look at the teachers, the aides, principals, all those people that made that school a success, rather than just saying this school has been successful, that we really drill down and say these are the people that made it happen. So just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, Department, and we'll move to testifiers. We'll begin with Ed Allies. And on deck, Minnesota Education Equity Partnership. So will you both come to the table? We're going to be timing your remarks. And B. Vang, will you be on deck? And Educators for Excellence as well. And testifiers, keep in mind that if something becomes repetitive, we don't need to hear it more than once or twice. I mean, this is for the sake of the department as well as for... our joint hearing. Welcome. And do we have Minnesota Education Equity Partnership at the table as well? So you have 3 minutes and you'll be getting some signage to indicate when you have to close up. So please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, for holding this important hearing and for the opportunity to testify. My name is Andrea Retke, and I'm the Managing Director for Ed Allies, a local education advocacy nonprofit focused on advancing policies that put underserved students first. We see ESSA as an important opportunity to revisit and strengthen Minnesota's approach to evaluating the success of our schools and supporting improvement, and we see public transparency as an incredibly critical piece of that puzzle. For the past year, we've participated in many of MDE's stakeholder engagement opportunities, including the accountability and educator quality work groups. And MDE has taken that process seriously. We're pleased that in a number of areas of the plan, we see the principles of equity and quality infused. Things like how student groups are weighted so that disparities aren't masked by averages, how MDE will assess teacher quality, and a lot of the other details shared with you today. What I want to use my time for is to highlight our two key areas of concern, which is around the process for school identification and the plan for public reporting, and how these two relate under the current plan. Today, as you know, MDE uses the multiple measurement and focus rating systems to measure school outcomes and identify schools for improvement. And as you heard earlier, MDE is planning to move away from this system and instead use what is called either a funnel or a decision tree process. And it's a significant change. As I laid out in my written testimony that was just passed around, we have some conceptual and some practical concerns with the proposed process. At a high level, we consider the funnel to be problematic because in many ways, we think that it actually decreases transparency. Under a weighted system like the MMR, every school gets a score that factors in multiple elements of quality, and it serves as a marker of performance for all schools. Whereas under the funnel, the public only really knows whether a school is identified for support or not. We would like a system that gives some kind of indicator to all schools of where they stand. And then some of our practical concerns come into play when we think about how the school quality and student success indicators are used as a tiebreaker. The funnel prioritizes the academic measures by putting them first, but then the ultimate decision about which schools receive comprehensive support is based on the non-academic indicator, which for now is student attendance. So hypothetically, the schools with the lowest performance on both proficiency and growth could be funneled out in that last phase. And we know based on the evaluation that MDE has done that that won't be the case for now, but we also have to remember that this drives behavior going into the future, and we want the incentives to be right. Clearly, attendance is important, but we also want those core measures to have the real weight that they should. So that also ties into the urgency around the public reporting plan. Since the identification process doesn't create those clear public ratings, we're concerned that that takes us a step back in terms of transparency and want to make sure that the dashboard MDE will be creating is robust, and that we understand that when communities are calling for more well-rounded data, it's not just about a call for making the data available, but truly making it useful. So there were some mentions of having kind of at-a-glance elements that help people understand what's in a dashboard, and we think that's really important. We wish there were more detail in the plan now, but we think over the coming year it's going to be absolutely critical that we get that right. Since the identification system does not do as much as we'd like for public transparency, we'd like to see MDE place a real focus on that in the coming year. And we'd love to see in the final draft plan more detail on the role of parents and individuals from traditionally underserved communities in informing what that dashboard looks like and how they'll actually be using it, and then how it will incorporate some of those at-a-glance snapshots to help people make sense of the data.
Thank you, Ms. Red.
Thank you.
We appreciate your comments, and they are available in your packets, members, and also to the public. Thank you very much. Welcome, Ms. Johnson.
Madam Chair, my name is Ara Johnson, a program director at the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, and our joint testimony with the Coalition of Asian American Leaders will be given by B. Vang.
Thank you, Ms. Vang.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for this time. My name is Viva. I'm an educator in St. Paul. I'm also a community leader with the Coalition Asian American Leaders. I'm here today with other members of the stakeholders group, as well as members of Cal. I'm here with my colleagues, Ara Johnson and Kanina, Policy Director of the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. These two organizations convened a group of 20 stakeholders and went through a year-long process to produce recommendations for MDE for the ESSA plan on the new English language proficiency indicator. I'm a member of that stakeholders group. Historically, we all know that schools have been held accountable for English language learners, reading and math achievement, and graduation rates, but as a separate accountability system for English language acquisition. Under ESSA, for the very first time, English language proficiency is placed at the center of federal and state accountability systems and improvement plans. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act came in the wake of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to address racial disparities in education. The 1974 Supreme Court decision, Lowell versus Nichols, determined that schools have an obligation to address any language barriers that prevent ELs, or English learners, from fully participating in schools. Over the past 20 years, the numbers of ELs in Minnesota has increased by 300%, making them the state's fastest growing student population, with significant growth in suburban and greater Minnesota districts. Minnesotan ELs are incredibly diverse in their experiences, challenges, as well as strengths, and, of course, languages. In 2016, there were 345 languages reported, with Spanish, Hmong, and Somali as the top three. Considering the largest concentration of refugees and immigrants is in the metro areas, there is a growing number of refugees and immigrants resettling in rural counties, increasing the number of ELs attending schools in those districts as well. Yet ELs often remain invisible and or inaccurately represented in education accountability metrics. Their academic progress has plateaued compared to their white, non-EL peers over the past 20 years. Even after ELs are reclassified, they are less likely to enroll in advanced coursework and courses that lead towards college readiness. Including progress or growth towards English language proficiency in the accountability system would strengthen the need for high supports to this unique student population and to also support individualized student services and supports. Also, ESSA will strengthen the Minnesota LEAP Act and World's Best Workforce, which I understand this body passed into law, with a stronger accountability and standardized evidence-based practice for schools serving this student population. This information is detailed in my policy brief, and I believe some of you may have received it. Today, I'm here to respectfully request your support. I urge you to work closely with MDE to elevate and also address the needs of Minnesota's English learners. This ensures that English learners receive equitable services, resulting in fully realizing their academic potential. We'll be happy to answer any questions you have now or in the future. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I think you'll find that that section of the plan is reflects your involvement, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam.
Are you speaking at all?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for coming and sharing with us. Educators for Excellence, Minnesota Business Partnership, and on deck, Dr. Sue Hammersmith. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Madeline Edison, and I'm the Executive Director of Educators for Excellence Minnesota, a nonprofit organization that works with about 2,000 educators in the metro area and advocates on issues of equity and excellence in education. I've been a regular attendee of the SO meetings held by MDE and a member of the Accountability Committee. I even have a certificate of consistent attendance to prove it. And in addition, the members of our organization have been advocates on this issue. There are lots of things to celebrate in this plan. I applaud the Department of Education for their very thorough community engagement practices and their willingness to seek out lots of points of view, and I think this plan represents that. I think it's also exciting to see the efforts to center the principles of equity and alignment with the world's best workforce in this plan. There are two areas that I want to call your attention to that I think more work is necessary to uphold high standards and center equity in this plan. The first is the school quality and student success indicator category. Because we're using this funneling model, which is unique to Minnesota as far as I can tell, I think exploring the implications of this model is very important, and one of them being that the school quality and student success indicators will be used essentially as a tiebreaker when comparing other indicators. When it comes to chronic absenteeism, we support the use of this measure as it meaningfully impacts student achievement, and there are very concrete steps that schools can take to remedy this this challenge. There are clear research-backed methods to improve attendance that schools can implement. The one caveat I would offer is that I think the Department of Education should really advise schools about focusing on time in the classroom learning, not just whether or not a student shows up in school. When teachers resort to punitive behavior practices that kick students out of the classroom, such as in-school suspensions, that should not count as a child attending school, because I think the spirit behind this is that they have the opportunity to learn. When it comes to the other indicators of well-rounded and college and career readiness, I think the principle should be equity of access and success in these categories, because if students of color, students with disabilities, or English learner students don't end up having success in those categories, then enrolling or having access to that opportunity is not enough. Another thing I would like to talk about is the exit criteria. So I want to call your attention to how schools are exited from the comprehensive support category. For the lowest performing 5% of Title I schools identified in need of comprehensive support, the proposed exit criteria is them not being identified in the next round, and I think that bar is too low. Given the relative nature of the funneling model, it is possible that a school doesn't improve at all despite receiving support, but if other schools perform worse subsequently, that they could be exited from the comprehensive support model. As another example, it could be possible for a school identified for comprehensive support to worsen in proficiency and growth, but to improve in the chronic absenteeism category and be exited from comprehensive support. To exit a school under those circumstances would create the wrong impression that that school is improving and could pull supports and resources that that school really needs to continue to receive that comprehensive support. So instead, we would propose that there be a firm bar for performance that requires schools to demonstrate meaningful improvement during that period to be exited from the list, which may also require MDE to support more than just 5% of schools. And if that's the case, then we ask that you resource the School Improvement Division to hold that high bar for accountability and provide adequate supports. Thank you for your time.
Ms. Edison, and thank you to all the testifiers who are being so specific in your concerns. I think MDE is learning a lot from your comments that you're making. So thank you for doing your homework and for reading the plan and following this. Mr. Bartholomew, welcome.
Hello, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. First, we'd also like to thank the department for their strong effort to include multiple perspectives in developing the draft plan. We'd also like to highlight a significant improvement in the ESSA plan over the state's NCLB waiver, the use of a student growth to proficiency model rather than a normative growth model. This change is important for students because it shifts from a model that doesn't expect improvement to one that's based on student progress and meeting grade level standards. And while we're still working through the draft plan, we'd like to offer some initial observations under the general heading of don't make things too complicated and keep the focus on student achievement. For example, dashboards can provide great information on student performance in schools. Unfortunately, the pressure will be to include too much information, making it hard for parents and the public to find critical information. As a result, we'd ask that the state combine a school rating system with the dashboards. Another example is the use of achievement indexes. Who wants to explain why we need an index and how a school earns index points? Instead, let's be transparent and simply tell people the percentage of students at each school that are meeting grade level expectations. Recognizing high-performing schools is another area where we agree with the department. That said, we'd ask that you not create a set of criteria to identify high-performing schools that is substantially different from the criteria used to identify low-performing schools. This will create confusion, and we may end up recognizing a school whose students aren't doing well academically. Two last thoughts. Generally, we support the department's proposal to use equal weighting of student groups when averaging things like graduation rates and academic progress. However, this may need some further work. For example, providing equal weight to a small number of non-low-income students can mask concerns with the performance of a much larger group of low-income students. It's inadvertent, and I think the idea is well-intended, but there may need to be some safeguards. Finally, we support the department's efforts to support struggling schools, like the bottom 5%. However, should these schools be identified for multiple three-year cycles, we'd argue the state should create additional educational options for low-income students at the schools. Again, we appreciate the department's willingness to engage and listen to a wide range of perspectives in preparing the draft ESSA plan, and with some additional work, we think the plan will help students in schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Dr. Hammersmith, and joining her should be Bailey Bolter from the Minnesota Alliance with Youth and Education Minnesota on deck. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is Sue Hammersmith. I'm a Minnesota resident and a retired president of Metropolitan State University. I am speaking today as a citizen. I am very active in anti-racism education programs since I have retired, but I'm speaking for myself. One of the things I want to do is not voice concerns, but to highlight what I see as some major strengths of this program that has been presented today. And they represent, I think, real improvements. One is the focus on disaggregated data. Cumulative data, composite data, is not actionable. This is the problem with talking about the achievement gap. It doesn't tell you what to do as a result. I am very delighted that this program positively recognizes the rich cultural diversity among our students. That's a turnaround. The incorporation of English language learners in the fashion it has been is very, very important. Also, the emphasis on culturally responsive pedagogy, curriculum, and community engagement. Another strength, I believe, is the attention to student growth, which has been mentioned, and to individualized educational plans. Students are not fenders that can be stamped out in a factory. And I like to see that recognition of the individual trajectory. Finally, I think it puts testing in perspective. Testing is an aid and not an end. What matters is what you do with the results of the testing. And I was pleased to see that it's built on not a deficit model, but a model that has high expectations for all students, including those new to our country and without financial resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hammersmith. Ms. Balter, can please join her, Mr. Winkler from Education Minnesota. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Bailey Balter. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bailey Belter, and I serve as the Youth Policy Coordinator with the Minnesota Youth Council. And we work directly with you all, the state legislature, as the only legislatively mandated youth voice in the entire country, which is pretty cool. So thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective today. A student would normally be sitting here sharing their own words, but as you can imagine, with summer schedules and work, it's pretty difficult to get here in the middle of the day. So I'll be speaking on their behalf. So a team of our members created a white paper this past year called A User-Driven Education System in Minnesota, Supplementing Standardized Tests with a Comprehensive Needs Assessment and Community-Developed Discipline Policies. This might look familiar to some of you. You should have received an email with this white paper a few weeks ago, and we've also included it in the record, so I highly recommend checking it out later. It's pretty quick and to the point and completely written by high school students. So as Minnesota writes its state plan for ESSA and figures out how to overlap with the world's best workforce, the Student Advisory Committee, which is the Education Committee, concludes that MDE needs to take this opportunity to write two supplements to standardized tests into Minnesota's state ESSA plan. The first is Comprehensive Needs Assessments, or CNAs, and the second is District-Wide Community Developed Discipline Policies. And just for time constraint reasons, I won't go over all of the details. Again, check out the report when you have time. But I just wanted to take a second to highlight those two pieces and why our high school students see that they are so incredibly important. So first, community needs assessments. If you don't know what they are, they're a process for schools to identify issues and how to best improve them. They essentially ask, what is our data telling us and what are we going to do about it? So self-identified needs and weaknesses a school is encountering, as well as graduation rates, testing scores, and other measures, they should be combined to create a holistic view on how a school is functioning. So CNAs are more efficient than standardized testing, but it's also a learning engagement for community members and students. The second recommendation is creating community-developed discipline policies. So we know that zero-tolerance policies don't work. In fact, many students, some on the council, report that they have felt humiliated, degraded, and not even a part of their school community after receiving punitive disciplinary responses. So we advise that more students are involved with the process on making those policies, especially from groups who are affected more disproportionately than others. So this, along with other policies that are spelled out a little more in depth on the white paper, would bring more dignity back into schools and weaken the school-to-prison pipeline. So students of the Minnesota Youth Council are convinced that together, community needs assessments and community-developed discipline policies would raise graduation rates and reduce incarceration rates. They would both, along standardized tests, allow for the actualization of ESSA's requirement of family contribution in a student's education and foster increased ownership from the entire school community. Enacting both of these two ideas that I just mentioned offer the opportunity for Minnesota to become nationally known for its inclusive and innovative education policies, concrete efforts to eliminate the school-to-prison pipeline, and, of course, highlight our powerful young people that we have here in our state. So, again, thank you for your time. I highly recommend that you check out that report. And there are a couple of paper copies over here if you want to grab one as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Balter. Welcome, Mr. Winkler, and please say your name again.
Paul Winkler from Education Minnesota. I am also worked for ESSA at Education Minnesota, and I was a member of the Accountability Assessment and School Improvement Committees at MDE. First, I'd like to say that this plan, I believe, really reflects the conversations that were had at these meetings. It was a hard, often hard conversations, but for the most part, I think this plan reflects the consensus that was built from those conversations. I think one of the this plan really provides a real opportunity to move from an accountability system that's geared towards fear and standardized tests to a system that, in the end, will help create more well-rounded schools. Schools and students are more than these just these test scores. One of the ways this plan hopes to create more equity in schools, we think, is through these comprehensive needs assessments that were just recommended. These assessments require engagement of parents, historically underrepresented communities, and educators to share their firsthand knowledge of what our students need to succeed. It is from these comprehensive needs assessments that we can create improvement plans and real change to better educate our students. There is also a simple but important difference between this plan and our current system, and I know there may be some differences in it, in our interpretation of it, but we believe this plan is much simpler to explain to our parents and educators. Replacing growth Z-scores with the transition matrix is just one example of making this more transparent and accessible to the people that are using the system. Of course, we have some disappointments and concerns. The biggest one is this system is still very, very highly reliable on standardized tests. It is not, our educators believe these tests to be at best incomplete measurement of what students know. And we know that there will be more meetings on this topic, but the plan's accountability system relies too heavily on these standardized tests. We'll be looking more at as we go forward, and we look forward to participating in the 30-day public comment period as we go forward. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler. Now we have a lineup of parents who may or may not represent organizations. Linda Bell and Taylor, will you both come forward? And Kelly Larson and Michelle and Nick Meyer on deck. So, Ms. Bell and Ms. Taylor.
I think the Larson's going to go first, if you don't mind.
Sure, that's fine. Welcome to our committee hearing. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is...
And you have to make sure you're near a microphone. So if you could just move your chair a little bit closer. Thank you, Tom. And thank you so much for coming today. Please proceed. Say your name and begin.
My name is Lene. In August, I will be entering 8th grade, an online public school. I understand that there is a proposal for Minnesota that Every Student Succeeds Act, including MCA student failure labeling. This is wrong. I have opted out of MCAs for 3 years, ever since I could not complete the test because my hand got too fatigued from the handwriting. That doesn't mean I'm not smart. I was in Gift Downtown to the literature study for a challenge for 5 years. Every year I have attended school, I have achieved honor roll in both semesters. The MCAs do not show my knowledge and are not an accurate way of determining if I deserve a labeling as a non-proficient student. They do not hold any incentive for the student or parent. There is no way of determining if I need to work on a specific subject, if I misread the question, or if I simply didn't have time to complete the test. Did you know online teachers have to drive hours across the state to get to testing sites? A month ahead of time, dozens of hours of class time used for answering questions and teaching curriculum is instead used to tell the students how to fill out the test correctly, read questions thoroughly, and complete dozens of practice problems. teachers are forced to prioritize the small group of students taking the test over the rest of the class who is suffering the consequences of their teachers being unavailable. Students opting out of MCAs should not be labeled as non-proficient. They are anything but non-proficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And you, sir, will you say your name and speak into the microphone and begin?
My name is Grant, and I'm going to be entering 10th grade. I do not support the provision that states that if students do not take the standardized MCA test, they are non-proficient. If this goes into effect, I will be non-proficient despite me doing very well in school. Currently, we opt out of the MCAs because it doesn't help me understand what I need to work on, and with my learning disabilities, it does not make sense for me. And at our school, the teachers try to somewhat prepare students for the MCAs during scheduled instructional lessons, so I miss out on valuable learning time. So in short, I do not see the benefit of this option.
Thank you for your testimony. And then who follows? Please come forward. Thank you very much, young people. Very nice of you to come and share that. I'm sure the department is listening, but you probably need to talk to your congressman, too. This is federal law.
Hi there.
Hi. Well, welcome and say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. My name is Sandy Hainer. Thank you for having me. I'm going to talk fast, so get your ears ready. I'm here to share my concerns regarding the ESSA plan before you. Let me begin by sharing a recent conversation I was having with my children. While telling them while we were coming here today, I used terms like representative government and consent of the governed in explaining why our politicians get to make all the decisions and we do not. They asked questions about current events that challenge that notion, and they were right, and it kind of felt like I was lying to them. Just a few months ago, we all read the published report from the Minnesota Legislative Auditor's Office in regards to MCA testing. The audit is consistent with ongoing concerns expressed from parents and teachers across the state, and there was a particular quote in the audit that I think is especially relevant to today's hearing, and it reads as follows. Some legislative requirements intended to improve testing have unintended consequences. I see the potential for so many unintended consequences in this plan. In numerous ways, children are reduced to buzzwords, future workforce dollars, test scores, and human capital who either help or hurt budgets, bragging rights, and rankings. Of course, there are those who will argue that and defend it using flowery feel-good phrases. But when we get to the bottom of it, they often have something to gain. However, your job is to use our money to represent and protect the children and taxpayers, not the special interest corporations or profit groups. I'm sure this committee has the purest of intentions and wants what's best for all students, and I can see how the idea of fulfilling a request from the Department of Ed might feel like a step towards that very noble goal. But to allow an organization to slap a label on a child they've never met or never tested is chock full of intended consequences. Consequences that do not represent the actual child, consequences that will most certainly be abused and manipulated further. There are many valid and important reasons that some parents choose to opt their children out of MCA testing. Whether you agree with them or not doesn't matter, as it is, they're right. MDE communication indicates that this is a choice many more are making. Perhaps it's not the opt-out families who are wrong and need remedied with punitive action like being labeled non-proficient. Perhaps, like the audit suggests, it's the federal testing process itself that is wrong. You are supposed to decide what is right for Minnesota families by listening to Minnesota families. Pushing a federal one-size-fits-all plan onto the state for a mere 3% of your budget seems very short-sighted and expensive. It doesn't represent us, it represents Washington. It's difficult to claim local control when state mandates teachers must teach to a test they did not create, cannot preview, and are not allowed to grade, and is rooted in standards they did not choose. We can't claim local control if the state encourages districts to pressure parents to go against their own wishes, and using taxpayer dollars to push the plan in the way that this proposes will create a climate of intimidation, aggression, tension, with children carrying the burden well into their futures. No one in this room should feel comfortable with that thought. Please respect the representative government agreement and uphold parental rights and student choice. To do so otherwise is to do so without our consent. When I was eagerly awaiting for the birth of each of my four children, I can assure you there was never one moment where I sat back, rubbed my belly, and thought, I can't wait for the day that you will be repeatedly assessed, labeled, shuffled into a pathway someone else picked for you based on economic need, and finally make all your boss's dreams come true. I've asked around, and it seems no one else I know ever dreamed of that either. Our children deserve to be seen as human beings, not the world's best workforce. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I do want you to know, though, that the standards are written by Minnesota teachers and the MCAs are written by Minnesota teachers. So this is not something from the outside. This is a fact.
Well, okay.
just so we have the record straight, we want to give those who participate in the testing and in the writing of the standards credit. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Chairman Pratt. My name is Linda Bell, and I thank you for hearing my testimony on the SS State Plan. If I have time, I might also perhaps read from a dear friend who has been to many of the ESSA meetings, Kristen Schultz. So my concerns. So state agencies and legislatures are meeting around the country as ESSA is reviewed. I realize that many here have worked very hard, in particular the Department of Education and others, but I bring a different viewpoint. The ESSA, to me, as a state plan, is the continued dangerous trend toward completely federalizing education. Thus far, standards, curriculum, and data collection for the workforce are systematically federalized. High-stakes testing is also in a federalized system and largely in place, but with one small open door, and that is the test refusals by citizens who wish to speak out against this intrusion. The ESSA plan clearly violates the education dictates of our Minnesota State Constitution as it completely federalizes education. At what point do we say enough is enough? Under that hierarchy of federalization and, let's face it, corporatization with mandates, I have two specific concerns and two broader concerns with the state plan. First, of course, I brought up the non-proficient labeling of students, which kind of usurps parental voice for us to be able to say, hey, we're not in on this. And there's a lot of us out there, lots and lots of us out there, and some who don't opt out want to. But I would encourage, even in the ESSA plan, and not worry about it being accepted, that an alternative labeling such as did not attend, which is similar to what we have had in the past, would be the MDE test refusal marker. Secondly, I take exception to the expansion of social and emotional standards, curriculum, and testing, as well as the escalating grab of student data and student profiling due to CEL. As a parent and former teacher who deeply cares about this situation, I wouldn't be here if I didn't, I want to see students learn real academics. Students who learn phonics and standard mathematical algorithms. Research shows that instruction in phonics and algorithms are the most successful across the board and for the majority of our student learners. In the broader picture, Minnesota schools teach curriculum that aligns with college and career ready. It's Common Core. It's all the same. And that has been adopted by many of the curriculum companies due to the copyright. However, Minnesota is fortunate to have outstanding and hardworking teachers, yet they are mandated to teach this curriculum, which is the core of what happens in schools, test the curriculum, and then be evaluated on that testing. This curriculum does not promote an intelligent citizenry. On top of that diminished academic instruction, we add social and emotional learning, values and characteristics that will be taught, tested, and data mined. I categorically oppose intentional, psychological, ideological, or political indoctrination, whether from the left or the right, and would encourage all social and emotional learning to be removed from this ESSA state plan. We already have some statutes that could be used in place of that reporting. The Very Good Character Development Education, Statute 120B.232, could be slid in, as well as the Minnesota Safe and Supportive Schools Act. We already have good legislation that protects students, and I don't think we need to go further. This idea of training kids exactly what to think is a dangerous and slippery slope. Allow teachers to teach academics in their own classrooms. Lastly, within this maze of ever-growing federal education programs, research from numerous organizations show that federal funding matched with all of these mandates are just not working. According to the U.S. Department of Education's own statistics, as well as the OMB and the NAEP test, federal funding in education has spiraled out of control, rising 375% since 1970. Many times the funding that comes in the door only pays for a year or two of these programs. Referendums are needed to cover the new programs at the local district and or property taxes rise. Or new sub-agencies are created within the state or federal Department of Education, which will require a sustained increase in state funding over time. Throughout all of the new programs, many are untested and adopted haphazardly, leading to poor results. Well, I want to especially see, students in poverty or with special needs given a hand up and funding. The research also shows that progress in educational achievement for the last 40 years has flatlined, and some years actually went below zero. So we put in a lot of money, but the success of these programs have flatlined. For those of us who are teachers...
If you would curtail your testimony.
I will, thank you. For those of us who are teachers, we know what works in the classroom. In order to teach standard algorithms, for instance, one only needs a paper, a pencil, and a piece of paper. That's all we need. I encourage our Department of Education, who has worked very hard to put this plan together, and our legislators, for whom rests the burden of authority over educating an intelligent citizenry in Minnesota, to take a hard look at the bigger picture of what has occurred over 40 years with federal funding and the myriad of federal programs. It's time to unentangle ourselves from this relationship and move forward for the betterment of our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. April Kane, I believe you're the last testifier. Ms. Taylor, okay. Will you come to the table, Ms. Taylor? You and Ms. Kane will be the final testifiers.
My name is...
So why don't you wait and we'll hear from a parent first. Thank you. Ms. Taylor, please say your name for the record and begin.
Ann Taylor. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Senator Pratt, thank you, and thank you, committee. Today I speak for myself through the lens of a parent having both a teenage child in school who will graduate in 2018 and my youngest child who is to enter kindergarten this fall. The complexities and profoundness of changes in education over the course of 7 to 10 years, and as Linda mentioned earlier, a lot more years than that, has left me both frustrated as well as angry, to say the least. There is nothing more disparaging than the usurping of parent rights and authority in guiding my children's education. When my eldest child switched from private to public education 7 years ago, nothing prepared me for the way in standardization. Nothing prepared her. Although in one of the most affluent public schools in the state, my child was one that did not do well on standardized testing. It was the teachers that knew of her potential, not a standardized test. My eldest child did not become proficient in reading until fourth grade, and because she did not fit the mold of standardized testing, and there were many and continues to be a multitude of standardized testing in public schools, the district decided for her she needed to be in remedial classes that lasted well into middle school. In those classes, it was evident she did not fit that mold either, and the teachers saw that. My eldest has since advanced into IB literature classes, is an honor roll student, holding two jobs this summer, and excels quite well in music and in the arts. Something no test or survey could have predicted for my eldest child, because I chose to opt her out of a system that kept her potential down. This spring, the Minnesota Department of Education had created a template for schools to use misinforming and manipulative language, I feel, in bullying parents into believing that they did not have the right to opt out their child of a standardized test. This seems to me completely unconstitutional. I've seen how districts are misusing data files and profiles of parents and children to guide and decide a child's future while taking the process of independent thinking out for themselves through the use of artificial intelligence that we call personalized digital learning, and most obviously, surveys instituted by both the districts and third-party companies for profit. Yes, thank you. Even with a survey bill in place, Statute 121A065, instituted in 2016, they are still happening because of the social-emotional learning aspect, the so-called effective use of technology grants that include mental health, and again, under the guise of personalized learning and equitable opportunity. This is massive manipulation of a minor. Both teachers and parents know a child's potential, not a test, and certainly not one that countless times has been known to fail the child because of the way in which the tests are made to set up the child for failure. Companies set the child up this way. With the new ESSA, I've already heard from parents in other states who are ramping up for their latest adjustments. schools this summer. I have school this summer. I've heard from parents and students that are encouraging the students to retake the standardized test over the summer in order to bolster their point system. This is not the definition of insanity and merely a way of cheating the system. Should this pass, is this what I have to look forward to with my youngest child? A system that punishes children with the label of non-proficient for merely exercising what is my parental authority, all parents' parental authority. I do truly appreciate the opportunity to speak today and encourage each one of you to seriously think about what you are deciding for families when it comes to be voting time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. You know, it's federal law and we have to follow the law, so I'm sure there are many of us here who have reservations about what goes on, but it is the law and we do follow the law. We take an oath to do that.
With respect, Madam Chair, it's about liberty.
Ms. Kane?
Madam Chair, Chairman, members, my name is April Kane, and I'm here to speak about ESSA Title IV, and I wanted to thank everyone here because many people worked very, very hard in the last session to pass Aaron's Law, and that is the people that held the hearings, the chairperson and the madam chair, all the members who listened, the legislative assistants, and the committee administrators, and thank you so much for all the hard work that you do. Aaron's Law was passed as a no-money, no-mandate, as a first step for Minnesota, and the Minnesota Department of Health created a report saying that Minnesota spends $8 billion a year dealing with sexual violence. The Associated Press stated that the U.S. spends $33 billion a year because we do not effectively prevent the sexual abuse of children.
So, Ms. Kane, to the ESSA plan, please.
Regarding the ESSA plan is that within ESSA Title IV, schools can apply for funds under competitive grants for a safe and healthy environment. And it is our hope that this information can be passed to all schools so that they know that Aaron's Law passed in Minnesota and that they can apply for a competitive grant under ESSA Title IV for a safe and healthy environment. The Department of Ed did tell me that they mentioned it in the RFP, which I'm very grateful of, but it isn't clear if the schools know if that is being reached out to them, if they are not directly going into the RFP and looking at that. Are they receiving the information that Aaron's Law is passed in Minnesota and that they can implement a program of personal body safety for children? And I believe that if they have that information, it could help the children. And without that, many children who are being abused, it shows up in many ways. For example, in mental health, them needing mental health, truancy, dropout, crime, children with disabilities being more vulnerable, and children also becoming sex offenders themselves while they are still children and in the school. So I'm hoping that the Department of Ed, who has been kind enough to mention this in the RFP, would consider sending out information to all the schools that this is available and possibly putting on their website and in the toolkit, so that the funds that are available at the federal level could be used for personal body safety programs for children in schools, because at this exact moment in time we don't have funds at the state level. But I did want to thank everyone for all the work that they did pass Aaron's Law, even though right now it is a no money, no mandate, but it is very wonderful that everybody worked so hard on that. And thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kane.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to... I'm sorry. We've missed someone?
Yes.
Oh.
Please.
Okay, go ahead. I thought that I called you before.
No.
Please proceed.
I'm Michelle. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I love the smiles that are on your face. And Sandy, I especially love your name because that was my mother-in-law who lived 8 years ago and died because she didn't have time to advocate for her grandchildren. So I am here for her. I am a mom. I'm a parent. I'm a sister. And I thank my kids for coming here and sitting without electronics. It is sad for me to see parents sit in front of electronics and to watch you guys on electronics while people are talking. I'm from the country. I live in the city. I ride my bike with my beagle. I'm called the Beagle Lady around, saying hi and waving at everyone that goes to work in the morning. I appreciate all of you.
I encourage people. I'm a mentor. My husband lets me stay at home. I get to stay at home because he works and makes the money. But I have dreams, and I know each of you do too. And I just want to remind you, encourage you of your dreams, and that you need to look and wipe out this plan. I'm learning every day, and I believe that you're looking at a federal grant, and there is an option to say no. I believe that the teachers are making rules and regulations and putting all this work here, and I appreciate them all. I do not go to the stadiums because I do not want to pay them more than teachers, firemen, and policemen in the military. Luke and Joe Smallbone, they have been through a lot of adversity, and I'd like to tell you what they have to say. Run wild is to risk everything to hold nothing back, to lay it all on the line, your reputation, your success, your comfort. It's that moment when fear is overcome by faith. Live free. It's not the liberty to do whatever you want, whenever you want, but rather living in accordance with the author of humanity and finding freedom by connecting with the Creator that conceived you and the people around you. Let the light that you see in other people's eyes flood into your eyes for the first time when you see them, if you have darkness. I had darkness. I was put on prescription drugs. My husband told me I was manic depressive. I only got there because I went on birth control pills, and it ruined my hormonal system. I am here today because people love strong. Without love, we all perish. I ask that you run wild with me. Live free. Love strong, because it only is you and me. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer, for your passion. Did I miss anyone else who wanted to testify who was on our list? I apologize if I didn't. Anyway, thank you again, Department of Education. I know you've worked hard. I know we have differences of opinion. And you've heard that today, not only from these parents who just spoke, and many of us agree with them, but, you know, we're also here to uphold the law. And until the Congress does something different, or Minnesota backs out of federal regulations, we're in this situation. So we thank you, Department. And members, I thank you very much for taking the time today to come. I really encourage you to read the plan, to read all of the information, to go to these public meetings, and to look forward to a follow-up meeting sometime in August. I think we need to hear back from the department in regard to some of the concerns that were raised, in addition to other comments that have come forward. Be sure, House members, you turn in your blue sheets. Just bring them up here, and after you've signed them, I will sign them. Senators, thank you very much. Senator Pratt, did you want to make some closing comments, please? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senators, for coming, and, of course, House members. I'm always so grateful to you for serving on this very difficult committee. We have some tough decisions to make. So with that, members and parents and others who came, thank you very much. We appreciate so much hearing from you. This meeting is adjourned.